Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 56 of our live monthly Ask the Experts Q&A with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing here at Cinten's. Our speakers today are in front of you. We have Associate Catherine Hope and Solicitor Samuel Scott, and their details are on the screen there in front of you. If you are listening to us via podcast, I'll run through the details at the end of the session so you won't miss out. Questions, as usual format, three questions our team are going to answer today. And these are questions that you've sent over to us over the course of the last month. And they're on the screen there in front of you. Catherine's going to go first. So without any further ado, Catherine, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us this Friday. So the first of our three questions this morning is about dealing with sickness absence. And the question is, can an employer deal with sickness absence during their absence under their disciplinary policy? So, for example, if they don't have a separate sickness absence policy. I think on the face of it, I can't see how sickness absence could be dealt with under a disciplinary policy, unless, for example, it was the situation where an employee, because of their absence, has triggered a procedure due to, you know, the certain level of their absences, you know, within a certain period of time. However, in this case, it would be really important to ensure that the employee and employees generally knew about the employer's policy in that regard, to discipline for that kind of absence and the potential consequences for that. I think essentially calling any procedure followed for sickness absence a disciplinary matter could give the wrong impression. You know, if you think they're very different situations, and this could, in my view, elevate the risk of someone bringing a claim for disability discrimination if, for example, there is an underlying issue there in terms of a health condition. I think that being said, and what's been mentioned here is, for example, if you don't have a sickness absence policy, you will, of course, want to follow some kind of fair procedure. And in this situation, this would involve a reasonable investigation and you having reasonable grounds for a genuine belief that dismissal is for an ill health reason. And if that fair procedure is based around the stages of your disciplinary procedure, suitably adapted, of course, then that might be regarded as fair, and it would be preferable, of course, to not following any kind of procedure at all. Because you've got to still think about following that fair procedure, particularly when someone has over 2 years service. That being said, I think solely relying on a disciplinary policy as it's written, or the procedure itself, or indeed referring to it as a disciplinary matter, I think it is an issue in my view and could be risky. It's all just about, you know, calling it a sickness absence procedure, you can still follow the same structure. I think it's also important to note, looking at sickness absence information and looking, if we look back to Section 1 of the Employment Rights Act, that sets out the requirements for the minimum amount of information that needs to be given to employees at the start of their employment. You know, for example, it needs to be set out in a statement of terms and conditions, which is often then forms part of their contract. And in terms of sickness, that needs to include any terms and conditions relating to incapacity for work due to sickness or injury, including any provisions for sick pay. And that information can either be, as I said, in the main statement of terms and conditions, or it can be, in this case, set out in a reasonably accessible document, such as, for example, an employee handbook. So if you don't have a policy, you should nonetheless be setting out the terms and conditions relating to sick leave and anything you will do in relation to that in a Section 1 statement or your contract of employment. So that is something to be aware of if you don't, to have those reviewed and looked at. It's better to have this kind of thing in a policy, I would say, if you can, and for that to be a non-contractual policy. I think in relation to this, going back to the question, I'm not aware of any authority for this type of situation, so I can't comment, for example, on how the tribunal might view it. But in my opinion, I think a tribunal would unlikely to look favourably on a sick employee being subject to a disciplinary procedure. It's going back to looking at what the situations are, and they are very different in terms of alleged misconduct and someone being off sick, particularly if you're looking at long-term absence. Going back to the question at hand, you could always follow the same structure if, for example, and I think it would be more appropriate if you're dealing with frequent intermittent absences, which if that led to dismissal, of course, you may well be relying on the potentially fair reason of conduct anyway, if someone's got at least 2 years service. So it's just, I wouldn't refer to it as a disciplinary or inviting someone to a disciplinary hearing. I would still be referring to it as dealing with their sickness absence. You're just dealing with frequent absences as opposed to someone being on long-term absence. But I don't think it would be appropriate to deal with it for someone who's been on long-term absence, because that's the kind of situation where you are more than likely needing to get medical opinion. And it just will involve a different, very different procedure. So that's question one covered. I'll pass you on to Samuel for question two.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. Thanks for joining our Q&A today. So the second question that we're answering today is, if an employee on maternity leave has another child before her entitlement to statutory maternity pay for the first birth expires, is she entitled to claim SMP for the first birth during the second statutory maternity leave? So if you satisfy the eligibility conditions for statutory maternity leave, which are that you earn at least £123 a week, that you give the correct notice, and that you've worked continuously for your employer for 26 weeks, you're entitled to statutory maternity pay. And statutory maternity pay lasts 39 weeks in total. So the first 6 weeks are 90% of your average weekly earnings, and the following 33 weeks are £184.03, or 90% of your average weekly earnings if lower. So for the large majority of employees, it will be £184 a week for those final 33 weeks of leave. So you're entitled to 39 weeks of statutory maternity pay, and 39 weeks is also 9 months. So this situation where there is a crossover is likely to be a rare situation that you come across in practice, because there will be tight timescales, and even if there is a crossover, the crossover is likely to be minimal and towards the back end of that 33-week period. However, it is possible, and it might be something that you have to deal with in practice should it happen. However, because it is quite a rare situation to happen, the guidance on it isn't as specific. So the first thing to remember is the statutory maternity leave and the statutory maternity pay are separate for each birth. So whether you satisfy the eligibility conditions, it'll be assessed at the date that at the relevant date for those purposes. And they should be treated separately. You don't exhaust any entitlement because you've used your statutory maternity pay in the same year. There's no provisions to that effect. Our view, and the view that's quite widely held, is that you can't receive two payments for statutory maternity pay at the same time. So if you had a second child with 4 weeks left of your 33 weeks, we don't believe it's the case that you would get £184.03 twice during that time. What would happen is that first period would come to an end and a new 39-week period would begin. However, the important thing to remember is that for that second 39-week period, when I go back to the eligibility conditions, it's based on how much you earn, and there's an 8-week reference period prior to the date that the statutory maternity pay would kick in. So that 8-week reference period would be while you're receiving statutory maternity pay. So the threshold is you have to be earning at least £123 a week. So if you are on statutory maternity pay and you're getting £184.03, then you're earning over that £123, and therefore you should still qualify for statutory maternity pay. However, that £184 is £184.03, or 90% of your average weekly earnings, whichever is lower. So if you did have an employee who 90% of average weekly earnings was lower than £184.03 and was potentially lower than £123 a week, there could be a situation where the employee isn't actually eligible for statutory maternity pay at the date that it's calculated for the second birth. So my first piece of advice would be, if you are dealing with this type of situation in practice, go back to square one and look at the eligibility conditions and assess it like you would, like you did for the first instance of maternity leave and statutory maternity pay. And again, just look at those factors and go, okay, has the employee given the correct notice? Has the employee provided the correct proof that they're pregnant? Assume the employees work continuously for you for 26 weeks, because that one's would be a given in a lot of situations. And then again, on the earnings point, you need to ensure that they're earning at least £123 a week. And your 90% calculation is going to be based on that. So go back to the eligibility conditions, check whether the employee is still eligible, and then take it forward from there. We don't believe that you would, even if you were eligible that second time, that you would get double statutory maternity pay. What would happen is that first period comes to an end and the second period begins. That's brilliant. That's that question answered. So I'll hand back to Catherine for the final question.
Thanks, Samuel. Our final question today is, how should an employer choose between multiple protected employees for a suitable alternative vacancy in a redundancy situation? So as we know, in a redundancy situation, certain employees who are at risk of redundancy are referred to as what is known as protected, and they will have an automatic right to be offered any suitable vacancies. And their employees who are on maternity leave, adoption leave, or shared parental leave, who are in a protected period of pregnancy and have notified their employer of their pregnancy, or who have recently returned from a period of maternity, adoption, or shared parental leave for an additional protected period. And that's covered by the maternity and parental leave regulations and other subsequent regulations relating to adoption leave and shared parental leave. Now, this is a question about a situation where there are multiple redundant employees falling into these particular categories, but only one suitable alternative role. The relevant regulations, and helpfully, do not give any clue as to how to resolve this type of situation. They merely say that where it's not reasonably practicable by reason of redundancy to continue to employ a protected employee under their existing contract, and there is a suitable alternative vacancy, the employer must offer them that vacancy on terms that are not substantially less favourable. And if there is a failure to comply with that duty to offer the employee that vacancy, that will render the dismissal for redundancy automatically unfair. Of course, in practice, you can't realistically offer more than one employee the same job. Even if you offered, for example, a job share, then the terms, for example, pay in particular, would inevitably be less favourable than their existing terms, so it doesn't satisfy that requirement. In this situation, I think some possible options could be you offer a voluntary redundancy to some or all of the protected employees in the hope that this will resolve the situation without dismissal. So, for example, that could be done under the terms of a settlement agreement. You try and choose between the protected candidates or remaining protected candidates if any have taken voluntary redundancy. In practice, I think assuming that the vacancy is suitable for all of the protected candidates, I think it's likely a tribunal would take a pragmatic view and decide that, for example, once a vacancy has been offered and accepted by one of them, there is no longer then an available vacancy to be offered to the others. Although there's, of course, no guarantee as to the view the tribunal would take. I'm not aware of any appellate authority in this particular question. If you're going down this route, though, this could involve, for example, looking at redundancy scoring criteria, looking at other criteria specific to the particular vacancy, or in some cases, carrying out a competitive interview among the protected candidates. I think all of these could potentially be valid routes, and there's no case law I'm aware of that dictates in this situation what you should or shouldn't do, with the exception of Sefton versus Rainwright, which I'll come on to. However, it's really important to note that whichever route you choose, that meets the usual criteria of fairness, because if there's no, you might be dealing with and removing the risk of an automatically unfair dismissal claim under the relevant regulations, but the usual principles for unfair dismissal will, of course, still apply. Example, if someone has the required service. Now, in the case of Sefton versus Borough Council versus Wainwright, the Employment Appeal Tribunal in this case held that the right in this case for an employee who's pregnant or on maternity leave to be offered the suitable alternative was framed as an absolute right under the regulations, which meant that a woman on maternity leave had the right to be offered a suitable alternative, even if they weren't the best candidate for the role. And they shouldn't be required to engage in any form of competitive selection process. And it's easy to see the policy reasons for that. As women on maternity leave and potentially anyone on extended family leave, they will inevitably be at a disadvantage, having been out of the workplace, focusing on childcare or their particular child, and they're less likely to have the time or energy to devote to the selection process and attend interviews. And whilst this particular case is binding in the tribunal in the case of a single protected employee, it doesn't really work, the reasoning in relation to where there are multiple employees who have the supposedly the same absolute right to the single job as we have in this situation. So I think it might be possible to distinguish Wainwright on the facts and argue for a more pragmatic approach. Of course, in this situation, the fact that one protected employee may be in the middle of maternity leave, whilst another may have returned some time ago after taking, for example, a much shorter period of, let's say, shared parental leave, it's likely to put the person on maternity leave at comparative disadvantage in the competitive selection. So you'll need to think about aiming to alleviate that disadvantage, which could mean, for example, in a particular case, avoiding an interview. You also need to be careful in this situation, if we've seen in the past, that although you may treat women on maternity leave more favourably than other candidates, you can only do so to the extent that is reasonably necessary to alleviate the disadvantage caused by being on maternity leave. So, for example, automatically prioritising them for a role over and above other protected employees who are not currently on maternity leave could in itself be unlawful discrimination against the other candidates. I think it's also important to look at the wording. So, for example, in terms of the relevant duty to offer suitable alternative vacancies, it only applies where it is not practicable by reason of redundancy for an employer to continue to employ an employee under their existing contract of employment during the relevant period of leave or the additional protected period. So the duty arguably does not apply where an employee is included in the redundancy procedure that is being run, for example, during their protected period, but where the actual termination date is after that additional protected period. So for me, this suggests that where it might be practicable for you as an employer to keep the employee employed in that role until the additional protected period has ended, that difficulty could potentially be avoided. And then that employee, once that protected period has ended, may then be fairly dismissed for redundancy after a fair procedure. Now, that comes obviously with a caveat that it's not, as far as I'm aware, being tested in the appeal court. So it's just to be aware of that. So it's an interesting situation, and we would be interested to know if you've had to deal with this in practice as well. So do let us know if you have. Thank you for your time this week. I will be back again next month for some further questions. So do send your questions in and we'll pick those up. Thanks very much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one as always. Very quickly for me, we continue to work hard to produce, release and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, podcasts, blogs, all of which can be found on our website at www.sintons.co.uk, and that includes all episodes of this live Q&A with our employment team. I popped our speakers' details back on the screen there. If you'd like to get in touch about this or any other employment-related matter, please don't hesitate to get in touch with either of them, both of them, or a member of the team via telephone. For Catherine, 01912263801, catherine.hope@sintons.co.uk. For Samuel, 01912263805, samuel.scott@sintons.co.uk. If you haven't heard enough from us at that point, you can also follow the team on Twitter at SintonsHR and at SintonsLaw, where we are posting lots of relevant and useful content throughout the month, in addition, obviously, to this live Q&A. I just need to remind you as well that we have one of our two annual employment law seminars next Thursday, and that is starting from 8 o'clock at the Newcastle Eagles on Scotswood Road. So you can find more information about the topics that we're covering just generally on our website, www.sintons.co.uk/events. And that'll take you directly through to the event. It'll take you through to full details and also the link to sign up, which will come directly to my team and we can get you registered. So if that's something you're interested in, then please do get in touch. I think that's it from us today. Thank you once again for tuning in. I frightened Samuel this morning when I told him quite how many people had tuned in today. It is a record number. Even after 4 years of doing these sessions every month, the numbers are growing and growing and growing each month. So thank you for that. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for watching the video online afterwards, for listening to the podcast, and also for continuing to send in your questions. We don't take it for granted and we very much appreciate it. We will see you in May. The weather looks beautiful out there today. I'm sure it's going to have a lovely weekend. So enjoy your Friday, enjoy your weekend, and we'll speak to you next month. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you.